returning for episode number 2 of the Happy Nipple Podcast. The first one didn't scare me off, so I came back around. I'm glad to be here with you. I really enjoyed our first episode with our doulas, but now we're turning to pediatric physical therapist named Dr. Aletta Najunas of Tulip Physical Therapy here in Connecticut. And you're thinking, what the heck? Why does my baby need physical therapy? And why is Lori talking about PT when she's talking about breastfeeding? I know, I seem like I'm all over the place, but I'm not. Lots of times babies have structural issues. They have growth issues in utero that make latching really difficult. And I don't think people understand that it isn't all on the parent sometimes to make breastfeeding work. Sometimes babies have challenges that need to be addressed. So you're going to find out so much more with our conversation with Dr. Najunas. It was fascinating. And I learned stuff I didn't expect either. So stay tuned. It's going to be exciting and interesting. And I think you'll learn a lot. And so here it comes. Are you ready for my nip tip of the week? Lots has gone on in lactation world for me this week. When I'm talking about the nip tip, I'm always thinking during the week, what can I bring to the podcast now? What are things that I'm saying and things that I'm seeing? And I'd like to address the Similac powdered formula recall that just occurred in the last few weeks. Discussion in lactation land has been about infant formula preparation. And it's been interesting to me. When I worked at a major hospital, we had these concerns about following the World Health Organization's guidelines for mixing and creating powdered formula. And the WHO recommendations are using boiled water in the formula. And we got pushback. We got pushback from the hospital. We got pushback from people who didn't want to be bothered boiling water. Why should we be bottling water? There are no problems. But really what can happen is that Cronobacter and Salmonella and other pathogens can live in powdered infant formula. It's not just Similac. There are, you know, you go through any formula manufacturers and there's recalls throughout the years. So the concern is not with your water. So we don't boil water for your water. In the United States, at least, if you're listening from outside the U.S., you may have different concerns about your water. But in the U.S., our water supplies are mostly pretty safe. I mean, I know that there are some outliers, but for the most part, water is safe. We're not boiling water for water's sake. As a matter of fact, your tap water is the best thing for your baby's formula. You can mix it pretty safely for the most part. Boiling the water, using boiled water or hot water to 158 degrees, and again, how do we get there? That's a whole nother discussion. But 158 degrees is known to kill Cronobacter and Salmonella in infant formula. The reason that powdered formula is powdered is because they can't heat it that high in the lab when they make it to make it powder. Do you see? So the nature of powdered formula is bacteria can live in there in the manufacturing process. And so that's why the recall happened, because their babies got ill and two died. So in creating infant formula, powdered infant formula, the best way to do it is to follow the WHO guidelines on infant formula. And you can look those up online very easily, but boil the water, let it cool a little. Again, I'm not sure about how little, and then pour that into a container and then put the baby formula, powder formula on top of it. So with hot water is killing that whatever potential bacteria is in the powdered formula. I know this is hard to fathom with all of the things on the market. The baby Brezza, I don't know, that makes me worried because there's formula that sits in there, that powder formula. The hot shot of water, does it get hot enough? I'm not sure. So I know that this could be a longer discussion, but for our purposes today, if you're concerned about bacteria in your baby's powdered formula, it's not the water. Using boiled water or hot water can kill bacteria in powdered formula. That is the safest way to make it. It's not going to work for every family. I get it. If you don't want to do it, I understand. But I just need to share that with you because we've had a lot of confusion around boiling water for water's sake and boiling water to kill bacteria in powdered formula. Now, ready to feed formula or concentrate they can heat that in the manufacturing process. So don't, that's not the concern. It's the powdered infant formula, which we know is more economical for most families. So if you want more of a discussion on this, you can jump over to our Facebook page at Oh Baby Lactation, or you can email us at obabylactation@gmail.com if you have more questions or need more specific guidelines. You can also check with lactation consultants in your area or the CDC or WHO websites. Okay, that said, that's the nip tip of the week about powdered formula. Bringing you now Dr. Aletta Najunas of Tulip Therapy as we discuss torticollis, sleep issues, swaddling. We jump into swaddling and we jump into tongue ties. So here we go. Enjoy.
Aletta, I'm so glad to have you here. She's a physical therapist. I'm going to let you tell her, tell the world a little bit more about what she does, because she's going to tell it better than I do. But I'm glad to have all of you at the Happy Nipple. And we're not going to just talk about nipples. I told you that. We're going to talk about lots of things. Breastfeeding. And today we're going to talk about physical therapy and babies and children, but we kind of span the globe. And so with that said, welcome, Aletta. Tell us a little bit about what you do.
Thank you. And thank you for having me. Mm-hmm. So I'm a physical therapist.
Yeah.
I've been in this field for over 12 years now. So I've worked with a lot of babies. Wow. And some older kids as well. I've spanned the baby lifespan from newborns and then up to school age kids, and some therapeutic horseback riding as well, which was really fun.
Ooh, that sounds fun. I have kids in my life that have done that. Autistic kids that did that, loved it.
Really, yeah, cool. I miss that. I used to live in Massachusetts, so that's where I did the therapeutic horseback riding. But that's
amazing.
My, kind of meandering around my career has brought me to a lot of working with infants and toddlers, and then a lot of working with kids with autism. It's kind of my two big groups of kids that I work with the most.
Awesome.
I love working as a pediatric physical therapist. I basically play all day. That's what I like to say.
So I'm looking at your website and I love that. So tell us a little bit about your name. Like, where did that come from? Tulip Therapy. It stands for something. I didn't know. Yeah. You were just named after a pretty flower, but according to your website.
It took me a long time to land on a name.
It does with any small business. It does. Yes. It's important, right?
Yeah, it's an acronym, and that's really what I believe in. It's therapy using learning and inspired play. And which is really what the function of what kids and babies do. They play, and babies, really they eat a lot. That's kind of their main function at first, is what, eat, sleep, and poop, and we help with all that. So it's really through play and, functional positioning and working with parents that I get everything done.
That is amazing. I love the play aspect. So you're almost like you're meeting the baby or the child where they're at, because that's what they do.
Exactly.
Find spaces to help within the normal function that they're exhibiting anyway, correct? Is that what I'm thinking?
Exactly. And I think historically, a lot of therapists used to kind of take things like torticollis and throw our PT stretches. We learn a lot about each muscle group and how to stretch and strengthen each group. But, just doing traditional stretches can be irritating to especially babies and newborns. So you have to think outside the box and think, how can I get that motion, but in a happy way, in a functional way?
Gotcha. And so I've been a nurse a long time, and I never understood the importance of body work until I started doing private practice lactation. And I was finding babies outside the hospital with a whole range of issues, babies that could barely open their mouths, babies who were clearly struggling with positional thing, that could not lift their chin or to open up wide, I could go on for an hour, all the things that we find. Sometimes I see babies right off the bat when they're first born, parents will come for lactation care and we struggle with latch, and they're worried that the baby isn't latching, right? They'll say those words. And then I look and I'm like, well, the baby can't latch. So there could be some compensations that happen, or maybe no latching at all. And so, and as I do this work more and more, I see those general structural issues really making a big difference for latch. So I think we're all so focused on the mouth and latching on the breast and the mother's or the parent's ability to do that. And so I see parents crying in my office because they can't, or the baby won't latch. And so they take it on themselves. And I'm like, okay, let's look at the whole picture. And then we're looking at some of the baby's compensations or the baby's challenges. And that's when I started to understand how important body work was and stretches were, and looking at the whole baby and looking at why they can't latch. And it's not usually parental technique or anything wrong with that. It's usually something that the baby is trying to overcome. So tell me a little bit about what you do when you see a baby. Like, what are you looking at? What's your kind of thought process? Where's your assessment going?
Yeah, so that's a great question. And I think when I first start and see a baby, a lot of times they're coming to me and they're in their car seat, you know, they got here somehow.
Right.
So I start right off with observation and say, like, hold on, before you take them out of there, I just want to see, what do they look like? Because I'll see babies who are pretty aligned, and then I'll see babies who are like this.
Hello, nice to meet you. I'm super cute. I used to think this was like a super cute thing. It's not super cute. They just can't move their head straight.
Yeah. And it can be telling, you know, and sometimes, you know, they're fast asleep when they come in, but they're like this. And I'm like, okay. I'm starting to already learn about some of their positional preferences or their, you know, strengths and weaknesses. And so I'll start right off with that observation of what do they look like? What do they look like when mom or dad take them out and they're holding them? Are they still really curled up? You know, depending on the age, that's expected or not. Are they holding their head one way, or are they having trouble looking one way or the other? So that starts right off the bat with the parents and how they interact with the baby. I like to see what that looks like. And then a lot of times I'll just, you know, lay them down on the treatment table and just kind of step back and take a look and just observe what their resting position is. Is their body in a C? Are they tight one way? Are they stuck looking one way and tilted one way? And it's so variable. But that's my general start, is just looking at, what does this baby look like at rest when they're not doing anything of work? Mm-hmm. And then I get into all the different positions. What do they look like, you know, when they're on their belly? What do they look like elevated, you know, so on my peanut ball or on a boppy pillow? How can they hold their head up better? What do they look like in side lying? You know, and I go with the flow of the session, where sometimes baby might get hungry and they might, you know, want to nurse or take a bottle. Well, what does that look like? What do they look like in that position?
So you will assess parents during feeding as well?
Yes, if they're interested. Some parents at first are just super overwhelmed and they've got this one specific concern. And sometimes I can kind of get that picture without necessarily watching the feeding, but I'm like, oh, I can totally see why they can't latch easily on the left breast because they're tilted the other way.
Got it. So can you speak a little bit about to what happens with babies? Because a lot of people say to me, well, why would babies need physical therapy? They're just born. Like, what the heck do they need that for? So can you talk a little bit about what happens in utero?
Sure, great. So it's one of those areas where I wish there was more clear research on the why. And I think it's hard to know the why babies present the way they do sometimes, which is the $1 million question, right?
Oh, nobody. Oh my gosh, yes, I agree. Yeah. Science only goes so far. We can kind of make smart deductions about other things, right?
But there are some factors that can start in utero. There can be some positional preferences that literally start when they're in utero. If whether it's, you know, the maternal anatomy, and maybe, you know, mom has a really small torso and baby just doesn't have a lot of room, or whether baby's just kind of happy just in one position. Maybe they're stretching their arms and their legs, but they're not doing flips and they're not rolling over.
Right. They're kind of crunched up against that uterus, kind of does this and they kind of get like this. And if they stay there for a while, correct? You can correct me, but that is it, the sternocleomastoid muscle here?
Yes.
Okay. And that can kind of become grown in a separate way, or kind of stunted in its growth, or tighter. Is that the way you
do it? Yeah. So we used to joke, or I used to joke with my son in utero. I was like, it looks like he's, you know, on a pillow, you know, they get in that cozy position, and some babies will just stay there. And that sternocleidomastoid muscle, it's the muscle in the front of our neck where you side bend, it makes a side bend one way and rotate the opposite way. So this is the muscle belly. So some parents will say, well, it's opposite. And I'm like, actually, it's the same muscle, but it does two different functions.
Interesting.
So cool. Some babies will actually develop what sounds really terrifying, but they'll actually develop a mass in the muscle belly. And it's basically like a giant knot of tissue that the muscle is trying to grow, but they're in this position and it's just getting stuck, and it'll just kind of grow into a ball, and it can take a while to work that out.
Oh, I love the way you explain that. That makes sense. Because there's all this growth, there's all this growth going on with the baby in utero, right? So
yeah.
If it's kind of compressed in an area, something could kind of go awry.
Yeah. Ah. And we see that with twins as well. If one twin was kind of squished, I'll often see that with twins, where one twin might have taken over in utero and been like, I am, you know, king or queen in here, and you get your own corner.
I love that. That makes sense to me, right? And there's only so much room in there. So yeah, if they like a certain position, some twins are rather busy at the beginning. They're kind of do. But then we all know, and anybody who's worked in our field and worked with twins, sometimes they get in positions and start to grow and they don't move. And sometimes they're breech or funky around each other.
Yeah, especially that's kind of a twofold thing with twins and babies who are born early, because you can get the positioning challenges if they're born really early and then they're just struggling to survive for a while, and that you're just doing the best you can just to keep that baby thriving. But then I also see it with, you know, parents who carried twins to term or almost to term, where, I mean, I can only imagine, I only carried one baby at a time. I cannot imagine having two 40 weekers inside me, but you know, it happens.
It does.
And the space, I mean, just the physiology of that from a human anatomy, you know, you can only have so much space. So it's pretty typical to have that squishiness, and they come out and they just need to kind of, I like to call it like unwinding. They have some tightness and they just need to unwind it.
Yeah. And I think too, I've heard the term gravity needs to work on our babies.
Yeah.
I love that term too. I feel like that really makes sense to me about what you need to do with your baby. And I think people sometimes too, I hear from parents, and I talk about this in my assessments about tummy time. I mean, I talk about the basics. Clearly you have much more in-depth conversations with your patients, but I talk about why tummy times matter. And I think sometimes people are like, okay, it's tummy time, and the rest of the time I'm going to leave you swaddled.
Yeah.
We can have that gentle conversation about swaddling if you want to dip into those waters, really. Just kind of, yeah, tell me how you feel about what's going on. I know it's an emotional topic. Parents look at me aghast, like, you know, when I'm like, maybe we shouldn't swaddle all day long. And they're like, oh my God, sleep. So there's got to be a balance, right?
I completely agree. And I think this is kind of three topics rolled into one. That,
I know.
First of all, the tummy time, just to even touch on, you know, some parents are not told when to start tummy time. It's very common. They have no idea, especially
first. What it is. They're like, tummy. Okay, yeah. Put the baby on their tummy. Okay.
Yeah. Flat on the floor. They hate it. But so, you know, I get into very specific recommendations for each client. But tummy time can start on day one, and it can be on the parent's chest, that like kangaroo care, that skin to skin contact, or swaddled. But you can start right on a parent's chest, and that totally counts. Totally counts.
Good point. Thanks for making that.
And then I think swaddling, and we can even touch on containers, those like jumpers, extra saucers, but even like infant seats. It's another can of worms, but swaddling can kind of become a container, which is why I bring it up. But, you know, I think in those first 2 weeks when families are just, they're just completely overwhelmed, and the baby's sleeping a lot. I forgive a lot of swaddling in that time, where baby might be sleeping a lot anyways, and they might kind of need to be, you know, cozy to stay asleep. And I totally understand the plight of new parents, where it's like,
yeah,
we've what both do I
been
do?
There.
Yeah, I'm sleep deprived, and I can barely function.
Yep.
But when baby starts to wake up more, you know, I see that a lot with our 2-week-olds and up, and it can kind of depend for babies that were born prematurely. It can kind of go one way or another, where they might start to be a little more active later or earlier. But in general, if we're taking a baby that's about 2 weeks old, or adjusted age about 2 weeks old, I want to start seeing a lot more openness and a lot more letting the extremities hang out and not just swaddling all the time. And you can even do that with younger babies too. You can, you know, they could take a little nap or a little playtime up on a parent, but kind of, you know, unswaddled, or you can just drape the swaddle over them if they need that warmth and that comfort.
Sure.
But just letting them start to stretch out. When babies are born, they're born in flexion. Everything is still curled up and they look like they did in utero.
Right.
But that starts to open up as we either allow them to start moving and as they want to start moving more.
Right.
Swaddling, sorry, what was that?
They need to kind of find their place in the world, like their physical space, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So swaddling, I'm pretty okay with sleep swaddling. When you hit 4 months, it becomes a difficulty. 3 months too, sometimes. Swaddling becomes difficult at night. You know, I always defer to safe sleep. And when a baby starts to roll, you can't swaddle anymore because then they could end up face down and they might not be able to get back, because if everything is curled up, you know, they might be able to clear their face, but you know, even some of that early rolling, which can sometimes be accidental, we have to be really careful about, because if they end up flipped over and they can't get back, then that could be a very unsafe situation.
Yeah, a challenging spot for them to be in, sure. Yeah,
absolutely. Unfortunately, at the same time as that 3-4 months when we start to see them rolling more, we start to see that moral reflex. So that's that startle reflex where the baby's head might suddenly move and then they get to all the arms and like everything is kind of extending.
Well, that's what everybody wants to stop happening, because yeah. Oh, and I hear from my clients all the time, they're like, oh, it wakes the baby up. They wake themselves up, and I don't want them to wake themselves up. They sleep better, they sleep longer, we all get more sleep. I am on the sleep train, man. Let me tell you, I get it. But again, yeah. I get concerned about, what do you think, what happens when babies are always swaddled and they cannot manage their extremities during sleep? Do we get to an age, do you feel like that's still that 3-4 month of age that they really need to kind of stop to do that? Or would you tell parents maybe to do a body swaddle and leave their arms out?
Yeah, so kind of circling back, I'm going to answer your question.
Yeah, go ahead, take your time. So, I get a little overexcited.
No, it's a great question, but I think kind of with that in mind, like knowing that 3 or 4 months, the swaddle has to start, you know, disappearing just from a safety. And a lot of babies, they just don't want to be swaddled, but they struggle with that moral reflex. So that's where you really want to let baby, even from an earlier age, be unswaddled and be, you know, either on their back with an activity gym and they can start, you know, swinging those arms around, or, you know, on their belly and they're starting to push up. So before that 3 to 4 months time, we really need to get them used to moving so that when that natural time comes where they start integrating that moral reflex, which is typically integrated by 6-ish months, but it's at 4 to 6 months that they are integrating it. But I see most babies, you know, 4 months, I feel like is that peak of difficulty where they're trying to sleep, they're waking themselves up. But I feel like if we really work on that daytime purposeful play, it can help that nighttime sleep because they're learning how to manage their extremities.
Wow, perfect.
And they're having that, and they're having that reflex during the day. And that's what starts to habituate or integrate that, is that they're getting used to it during the day. So at night, they're not as alarmed.
Perfect.
If they're in a container a lot of the day, they're not getting that practice because they're still flexed. And I am not just, you know, totally anti-container, because obviously parents need to cook dinner. They need to care for siblings. There might be times that they might need to put the baby in a safe place, like a, you know, little infant seat. But there's also times that they could be in a safe place and be in a pack and play. Like we have a small master bathroom. We could just fit the pack and play in, you know, between the sink and the shower, but I would roll it in and I'd put the baby in, take a shower, and I could still see them. They were perfectly safe, but they're also not fully contained. They can still
move. So I think that's a good point for someone who has lots of these containers around. And I think the word container, for me, it's kind of like, oh, is it a dumpster? No, of course not. We mean containers.
I know, it is an awful word.
I know, but it is. They are. It's a swing. It's a infant seat, the little vibrating thing that goes, that holds your baby at that scary angle.
Yeah.
Worry about, you know, that. So there are, and you know, I have three kids, they're 24, 26, and 31. And I, you know, that's all we did. We didn't know, I didn't know any better. You know, we just put them in a thing because I thought that that's what you had to do. But the, so the more we learn, the more we talk, the more we understand how important it is for babies to be able to move. And again, that point that I made before that somebody else told me, babies need to move against gravity. They need to have like natural open movement of their extremities. So I think that there's, so tell me how you feel about like nap and sleep with swaddles. I mean, is it nap? Maybe should we not be napping them with a swaddle and just at sleep at night? I mean, where do you find that happy place?
I think it's hard to put, you know, one like prescription on it.
I know,
it's
so I'm sorry.
I like my big thing is I like to say, I really believe in working on everything in the daytime and nighttime will get easier from a PT and mobility perspective. I know there can be a lot that goes into it on other angles.
Oh yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I really feel like, so I guess with my own kids, I started to reduce that swaddling. I found it easier during nap time because then, you know, it's a shorter window and my kids were mostly cat nappers anyway. But even if you have a baby who likes to take a big long nap, you know, I find that to be a more, I guess, a less challenging time to start to mess around with that swaddle because first of all, the parents are usually not trying to sleep at the same time. Like at nighttime, that's where it's hard because we're trying to sleep. And if baby is constantly waking themselves up, then we're also waking up. So I like to try to wean that swaddle off during nap time if we can. And then it's also a way that parents can kind of monitor what's going on where they can maybe kind of peek in or watch through the baby monitor, like for, you know, not obsessively, but kind of peek in and see like baby's making noise. What's happening? Is it their arms or are they just, you know, did they have an air bubble and maybe they're just a little fussy? You know, it's hard to know, but you can kind of almost take your own data during the day and kind of observe and see like, did they just wake themselves up like this? Or was it something else unrelated? And I think that it becomes a challenging conversation because there can be a lot of reasons that babies aren't sleeping well, which is a whole nother can of worms with, you know, reflux and tongue ties.
There's a whole other 75 episodes coming about.
We could talk for an hour.
I know we could.
But that can be part of it too. If there's just, you know, that aerophagia, if they're swallowing air, maybe they've got air bubbles. So baby might look fussy, but it might have nothing to do with the swaddle. So I think that can be confusing too.
That's a very good point. Yes. I understand what you mean. Sure. Too. And I think,
but in general, I think it's easier to work on it. Yeah. In general, I think it's easier to work on that weaning swaddle during nap time where, you know, maybe you need to conserve your nighttime sleep. I totally get that. So if you're going to pick a battle, I would try to start it during the day.
And then start to think about that time frame of 3 to 4 months of maybe backing off of the swaddle at that, as you move towards that. Is that what you're thinking?
That's where, you know, I see it out of necessity where, you know, when you start having that baby showing signs of rolling, or if they really start truly rolling by then, it's just becomes a safety hazard that they really need to hurry up and get that swaddle, you know, reduced. But, and I know there are some babies that could probably sleep swaddled for months and months past that because they like to just sleep in one position. And some families kind of get away with that. But I'd say that's not as typical to have a baby who literally doesn't want to move in their sleep.
I understand that. That makes sense. But then the baby can maybe find their own snuggle. You know, they can snuggle up to their arms or maybe at the edge of the crib and kind of tuck their head if that's what they like to do, because then they can autonomously move that way, right?
Yeah.
You know, so and that makes sense that they can find their own kind of snuggle.
Yeah. And I see a lot of that parents who comment that like their baby likes to kind of migrate over to the edge and not sleep with their face against the edge, but they kind of like to bump
feel
up
it, like the uterus. It all goes back to living in your first home, the uterus. You know, you were all in there, and some babies find some great comfort in that. But I always remind my clients too that we want our babies to wake up. That's what the Morrow reflex does. It protects them. It protects them. So the Morrow, you want to explain a little bit about where that comes from? Because some people are like, "What are they talking about?" That startle reflex. Yeah.
Yep. So our reflexes, there's a lot of reflexes, which are just automatic movements that we're born with. And they all serve a purpose. They can, you know, they kind of come and go at different stages. That's another 1 hour conversation.
Really? But, I'm going to have you back.
Yes. I know. Again. Our reflexes, so things like you notice, like the baby, the ATNR is really, I think, the most obvious one, where the baby looks one way, the arm that they're looking towards goes out in extension, and the other arm comes up in flexion.
Yep.
And these reflexes, a lot of them, you know, stem from baby just trying to get out if it's a vaginal birth. So they're kind of trying to get their way out. And obviously, you don't have enough space to do this in birth, but that whole process is what a lot of those reflexes come from or are geared towards. Just naturally, our body is like, okay, we got to get a baby out. They don't have a lot of, or really much of any motor control.
How can they help themselves get out?
Exactly.
Sure.
So that's what a lot of these reflexes are based on. And the moral reflex is that startle reflex. So baby's head comes back and their arms are going out. That's really what you see.
The ones where they do this, they look,
Yeah. And that's kind of a protective response. And, you know, it's, I think if you think back to, like, I like to reference cave babies. If you think back to
babies, you talk about cave babies all the time.
Yeah.
No cave from here.
You know, if they were starting to fall, you know, I guess it's like a different time, you know, that we live in now. We're pretty connected to our babies. But back in a time when maybe we weren't as connected, or maybe baby was, you know, up on something and starting to fall off of, you know, their rock cave bed, or in modern times they're on, some people might put the baby on the couch and baby's wiggling towards the end of the couch and is starting to fall off. They're going to startle. They're going to, you know, they might cry, and that's that, like, help, help. I need help. So that's part of that.
Like reflex. That's like, I need help reflex. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in modern times, you know, we're seeing that a lot, you know, in that 4 month period, that's where a lot of parents become aware of it, in that sleep regression where they're waking themselves up. But, you know, I think really that daytime, if we're giving them that opportunity to move around, they're doing it a little bit when they're on their, you know, activity gym, but they're learning, like, okay, I did this, but I'm safe. I didn't fall off a cliff. I'm still here.
My cave.
Okay. Yeah. So that's where it starts to integrate more, is, you know, baby is starting to move around and they realize they don't truly need help. They're not truly in distress, and they start to self-regulate. So some of that self-regulation comes in there too.
When you say integrate, we just mean kind of manage through that reflex. Is that a good way to say it?
Yeah. Because it naturally, as part of our neurological processes, is these reflexes typically don't persist. You can have it actually persist. That's another. But they can persist sometimes. You know, with our neurological, you know, maturation with some infants and toddlers and older children, some of these reflexes might be partially present, and they look different in older kids, but that is something that I will test for in school age children, is if it's fully integrated. And you can actually see that sometimes it's not fully integrated, and they'll still have slightly automatic reactions that they shouldn't necessarily have. And a lot of that is part of our brain and our myelination of our nerves. So it's basically how our nerves are growing and developing. And that's a slow process. It just naturally is. It takes time, you know, for that myelin to kind of build itself, and we can run into bumps in the process along the way. You know, I'd argue that nobody is perfectly perfect, so everybody has something, you know, if we really look at it. And so for some people that can be harder to, and babies it can be harder to kind of get through that, but in general I really think it's a lot of practices that we can do as parents, you know, to let babies move around so they can naturally promote those processes, naturally have that neurological maturation.
Awesome. So I'm going to turn us back to talking about babies that I see and babies that you see. and feeding issues. And specifically, we're going to talk, we're going to say for the first time on the Happy Nipple Podcast, tongue tie. We're going to have lots of discussions about tongue ties because, oh yeah. And it's like an onion, isn't it, Alita? Like boop, 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 boop.
I'm laughing because,
oh,
this is where some people get angry, but yeah.
Yeah. So we're going to, well, no, we're not going to, no, no one's getting angry over at the Happy Nipple. No, no, we're going to talk about it until we want to talk about it. That's the best part. So for when you and I are seeing each other and we're talking about body work, or I use that term because I also work with some great chiropractors who do infant work as well. So talking about what babies need for, if they've got oral restrictions, and we're going to, I use that term interspacefully, and for someone who doesn't know what I'm talking about, tongue tie or oral restrictions in an infant can impede breastfeeding and lots of other things. But again, there's more to have conversations about. But for our purposes, we see, and I see people come into my office specifically for tongue tie evaluation, or they are on the internet and somebody told them that their baby had a tongue tie and you're nodding your head. I know that this is all going to be so familiar to you. Or their pediatrician said, I don't know, go see somebody else, which I love living in Connecticut because most of the pediatricians that practice here at least agree that oral restrictions can be hindrance to breastfeeding and babies gaining weight and maternal pain, et cetera. When you see a baby who was referred to you with some kind of feeding issues, specifically at the breast or sometimes on the bottle. We know sometimes bottle fed babies really struggle if they have oral restrictions or tongue ties. But tell me kind of where that process leads for you. And we talked a little bit about torticollis or general kind of gross motor things, but can you talk a little bit about what you assess with a baby in the mouth and maybe what a typical visit would look like with a baby who's struggling with feeding, or either before a procedure or without? I mean, a lot of families who maybe don't need a frenotomy. For those of you who don't know what a frenotomy is, it's a snipping or a release either via a laser or scissors of a tongue tie under the tongue or a lip tie or any other oral restrictions. And again, another episode. But for our purposes, tell me a little bit about what that looks like for you.
Sure. And I think an important point to note for anybody who's, you know, possibly tuning in from other areas is that this area is very specialty in the world of physical therapy. So you can't just go to your physical therapist down the street who treats adults and say, can you look at my baby's mouth?
Oh, that's that's a really good point to make. Thank you.
You know, and even infant care I would consider a specialty area within the world of physical therapy. So the reason I bring that up is it can be challenging in some places to find even a pediatric physical therapist who specializes in infants.
Right.
Because for most PT programs, we graduate as generalists. We're not specialists in one area, you know, and that's kind of the purpose of that is that then we need to go do a lot more continuing education to, you know, travel down one specific road and make that your specialty area. So I'm saying this with the caveat that I've done a lot of, you know, self-study and continuing education. And even the continuing education is hard on the PT world because it's not always geared towards PTs, but there's some out there. You know, that's my first step is like, how do they look functionally externally? And then I will look in the mouth. And I talk to parents about, you know, how I stay within my scope of practice. PT in general, we don't get super into like the, you know, the swallowing aspect of eating is more of like a specialty.
Speech language. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. More of speech.
FLP, yep.
But we do learn about our oral facial muscles and, you know, the body, you know, you can debate it, but the body is connected. One part's connected to the other.
Totally connected. Totally.
We have fascia, which a lot of that tethered oral tissues is just tight fascia. And that's impacting the rest of the body. It's kind of pulling everything up, which is where we get that tension. Yeah.
And the best.
Yep. Yep. So I will look into the mouth and just kind of see what's going on in there. I do feel like it's important for me to visualize that. And you know, you really can kind of see it almost externally sometimes in how the baby's looking, you know, if the cheeks are really tight or if the chin looks like it's been pushed in and they're like,
right.
Yeah. So I like to look in and see what that looks like. And I tell parents, it's not within my scope of practice to formally diagnose tethered oral tissues. You know, as physical therapists, we make treatment diagnoses. So we would, you know, make a diagnosis of, is there a muscle weakness or a stiffness in a joint or other lack of coordination? So in general, I tend to see a lot of that muscle weakness and stiffness coming along with the tethered oral tissues. So it kind of all goes together, but I feel like it's really important to be knowledgeable about the mouth if you're treating an infant with torticollis, because you might, or plagiocephaly or any of the tilts, because there might be something huge going on inside the mouth. And if nobody's looked in there, we're trying to treat everything else, but we're still going to tend to have that tightness. And, you know, it's just an important thing, because I will sometimes have families that have come and they've never been to a lactation consultant, or they've gotten a helmet. They've been referred for a helmet for plagiocephaly without ever seeing an IVCLC or a PT. And that does still happen. So it's kind of like band-aiding a problem that's underlying. Right. It's really a huge can of worms, but I feel it's important to look at that and to see, you know, what's happening when they're feeding. And I really see positioning to be a big issue. Not that the parent is challenging or you're struggling with positioning, but the baby itself is struggling with positioning because they're tight. So it's harder to turn one way or the other.
Oh yeah. Sometimes I'll see babies at the breast who will cry or really fuss in one position, and you change their position and it's much better. When I worked at the bedside at the hospital, I saw that all the time with brand new newborns. And it was amazing to me, like, to make that kind of assessment, like, why is this baby struggling? And then I realized, oh my gosh, his head probably hurts. Yeah, it just kind of came out, or a baby with a big hemangioma, or not hemangioma, just, you know, big habit from, you know, from birth or for forceps, or just had a rough ride out anyway, and he can struggle. So it must be uncomfortable. So yeah, positioning is a big deal.
I wanted to touch on the timeline of things.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, the American Physical Therapy Association did this big study, or what they call a clinical practice guideline, which was reviewing a lot of research about torticollis and plagiocephaly. And I see most of the babies I see, they don't have a diagnosis, but I call them to myself. They're like pre-torticollis, pre-plagiocephaly. Like, they're going to get there if we don't work on things.
Right. If we don't move and start doing something to stop it. Right.
Yeah. It's kind of imminent, but we can avoid it.
Right.
So this comes from the torticollis clinical practice guideline, but I find it to be applicable for babies who aren't diagnosed with torticollis, but have some of those similar characteristics.
Yep.
So they found that a research showed that babies, when they started physical therapy at 2 months old, they needed an average of 2 months of following to, you know, meet their goals and graduate.
Be done. Right.
That's pretty quick.
Yeah. 8 weeks.
But when babies were referred at 4 months old, they needed an average of 6 months of intervention.
Oh.
And then when babies were referred at 6 months old, they needed 11 months of intervention.
Wow.
And I found that to really align with my clinical practice, where if we get babies early, where we can kind of teach that mobility, it's so much easier. Rather than waiting till they're 6 months old, they're crazy tight. They've got a huge flat spot, and that's not everybody, but still when you wait longer, it takes longer to do what we call that neuromuscular re-education, or teaching that mind body connection and working on those better movement patterns and postural symmetry.
Right.
So early is best.
Early is better. I'm hearing that, definitely.
And it's hard because I know a lot of, you know, pediatricians and primary care providers might say, like, oh, let's wait and see.
I gotta say that sometimes because I want to be, especially when it comes to tongue tying issues, I want to make sure that we're not doing procedures to babies that don't need them. That's really important to me. And I think lactation consultants get a bad rap a lot because we're like, people say, oh, all they see is tongue ties. So what I love to tend to do is send babies to people that do what you do, because it's non-interventional. Babies usually love it. It makes parents feel like they're in control of some of the baby's function and growth. And it avoids cutting things that maybe we don't need to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I completely agree. And you know, I would never, you know, want to like hope for more babies to have procedures that don't need it. And some babies, they're fairly functional without it, but then having a little bit of work done, they can work through it and kind of grow into whatever their anatomy has given them. And then they can thrive from there. But, you know, when you, I'm sure you must get all the time, those really struggling infants where they're really, really struggling to feed and they're so gassy and they're not sleeping and they're screaming for hours at night. Nobody's, you know, nobody's happy. Nobody's succeeding in that situation.
No,
there's things they can try before maybe, you know, parents go to have a procedure, but there's things we can try and see what we can do to help them.
That's the thing. You can see there's lots of babies who are kind of on the fence who definitely have some tightness or some oral tissue, some problems with their oral tissues, but you know, maybe they don't need to rush for a revision because they've got lots and they're growing and they're gaining and mom's maternal pain is very little. So it's a really, like I said, it's a very individual assessment. So if a parent thinks that something's up with their baby, where should they start their process, wherever they live?
Yep. That's a great question. So in the state of Connecticut, physical therapy is considered a direct access care. So we are able to do evaluations without a physician's referral.
Okay.
And I throughout my experience so far, I have not encountered any insurances that require a referral. Sometimes that can come into play. So depending on the state that people are in, some states are not yet direct access for physical therapy and they might need a primary care provider referral. I think it's getting pretty low, the number of states that are not yet direct access. The other caveat with that is that in some places you might be trying to go to like a large hospital clinic or a large clinic, they might require a physician's referral. So sometimes that does come into play, but you don't necessarily need to have an office visit for that. You could, if you've already been in touch with a physical therapy office and that particular office requires a referral, sometimes it's just a phone call to your pediatrician to say, hey, you know, this is the concern, you know, can we have a referral faxed over, sent over to this provider?
We're all on the same team. Pediatricians want to do the best for their babies too.
Yeah. So it can really depend on the area, you know, how you get access to care. I think on a lot of areas, your primary care provider is really the best first, you know, access point.
Sure.
If you're not totally satisfied with like if they're like, oh, let's wait and see, let's give this another month, or you've given it a couple weeks after your, you know, 2 month well visit and they're not going back for two more weeks and you're like,
right, if it's in between and things aren't well, right?
Yeah, they're really stuck. Then, you know, you can look into, you know, pediatric physical therapy in your area. And unfortunately, there's still a lot of virtual physical therapy across, you know, the state and other states for early intervention care
for COVID purposes.
Well, I think it kind of became an excuse to have one provider sitting in one area so they could see babies boom, 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 boom.
Oh, volume, of course.
They have to go house to house.
Oh, I get it.
That's my fresh take on it, that I don't think that's really appropriate anymore, you know, because how can you feel those muscles? How can you?
So there is always, hey, I say that in my practice too. I do virtual stuff and it works great, but nothing takes the place of a good old fashioned assessment. And some parents don't do well. We're kind of zoomed out. I mean, in another time and place, you and I'd be sitting in a room together, maybe in the summer, we'll do that. So we know that life will try to go back. So parents are coming to you. They're coming to you. Where would they find you?
Yep. So it, just for me in particular, I have my own website. I don't know if you want me to get into kind of.
Yeah, please do. I want people to know where to find you.
Okay. So I'm Tulip Therapy. So my website is Tulip, like the flower. So T-U-L-I-P therapy. It's all one word. Or tuliptherapy.com.
Right.
I'm on social media at Tulip Therapy LLC. But, you know, there are a lot of great pediatric providers across the country. So even if you're not in Connecticut, you know, sometimes social media is one of the best places to find people in your area. It can still be hard, but generally, like, you know, Google searching for pediatric physical therapy in your area if your provider, I mean, if your primary care provider doesn't have a good referral, but also your local IBCLC is a great resource. Well, they have got those connections.
Yeah, hopefully your local doulas. Doulas are good about referring physical therapists, chiropractors. Usually what I have found in the last 6 years of private practice has been that referral system, at least in our area, I know Alita, is really strong. And I rely on it relentlessly for parents. So when I say to them, I want to send you to here's your choices. We always want to give choices for care. I'm so happy to know that we have such accomplished people in our area. And I don't feel bad about sending my families to, you know, the chiropractic referrals that I have, the physical therapy referrals, that it really makes a difference. And I think that parents appreciate that confidence that I have in the providers that work together. So we got to wrap up. I just enjoyed this. I learned some things. I hope other people did too. And so to reach you on social media or at your website, you take a bunch of insurances too. We should probably mention that.
I do. Yep. I'm in network with most insurances in Connecticut.
And, awesome. Everybody has different coverage, but that's something that they can find out when they reach out to you.
Yeah. Yeah. And in general for infant care, you know, it's not as challenging as when they're three and older, the limits and, you know, restrictions can kind of increase, but, you know, and I always encourage parents too, they can call their insurance and find out the details too, because sometimes they get answers faster than we do.
Oh, this is very true. I agree with you there. But listen, thank you for joining us. I was so happy to have you in my referral circle. And let's get together again. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much.
Take care. I appreciate it.